So, without further ado, I have enormous pleasure in calling up Richard Cornish and Hilary McNevin, who for the third year in a row will look after us with conversations today.
Thank you. I think this. Thank you, Liz. Hello.
Morning.
Good morning. I love the familiar faces and new faces. This is exciting.
We'll sit down here, I think.
Let's.
Good morning. My name is Richard Cornish. I'm a food writer from Melbourne, and I write about where food comes from and why it tastes so good.
And I'm Hilary McNevin. I'm also a food writer and content creator, and I write for food businesses and also write about food and drinks for people who love to make food and drinks.
And the two only registered food writers in Australia who do not accept freebies. There you go.
It's a fact.
All right. Conversations. We're being recorded today for the local radio station and for podcasts, and so this is a public event. And this is a community event as well, and we'd just like to recap on the last couple of days. Hilary?
Friday night, we had the most wonderful, wonderful dinner.
Who
was there on Friday night? It was just full of joy.
I think I was there.
Nick thinks he was there. Not quite sure.
We have the evidence, Nick.
Yeah. I did film a lot of that. I'll call you later about that one. Anyway, yes, it was a beautiful dinner. Alejandro Saravia was the chef.
And some amazing seafood coming out of the bay here, and vegetables from Jody at the
Green Acre.
The Green Acre, yeah. So that was sensational. Yesterday, who had a chance to look around the Harbour Day yesterday?
Anyone?
Yeah.
Everyone?
Well done to the community. Really good show. So good to see putting a real community face to face with a whole lot of people from Melbourne who are wandering around bewildered. Why are these people so relaxed? They were saying, yeah. You've never seen so much activewear.
So much activewear and so many smiles on people's faces. People aren't looking rushed and stressed.
The transformation was amazing by the end of the day.
Leisure wear was everywhere.
And and that day brings us to one of the highlights for us of the Apollo Bay Seafood Festival, which is Conversations. This has been, as I said, there's been podcasts as well. And those podcasts, Bob, I think, have been listened to over 100,000 times now.
Yeah,
give or take
10,000%.
Yeah.
Wow. So you could, yes, they keep some people company on long drives, we've been told too, which is really, really great that the last 2 years of talks, and we're only adding to it today.
So today, it's called Submerged, but we're putting this into a context of leadership.
Nice.
I think we've been bereft of top-level leadership lately.
Speaking of leadership, nice Hawaiian shirt.
Oh, shut up.
I'm sorry.
Shut up. You're naughty.
Sorry.
So we just want to put out the people who are speaking today are community leaders. They live their lives. They don't sit back and just... They're not passive people.
No.
They're actually out there doing some of the most amazing work in their field. They are knowledgeable, they are educated, and they have experience, and they're respected by the community.
And they're proactive, they're thinkers, leaders, visionaries,
people
who want a better world for all of us and are happy to make a lot of mistakes, pick themselves back up again and keep going.
Yeah, so we're really lucky to have so many people like that in the room today. So thank you for those people for coming, and thank you for coming as well. The other thing we wanted to put into perspective was, what was the other thing we needed to talk about as well? Community, respect, leadership.
Leadership and enjoying the day.
Yeah, exactly.
I think really that's where we're at.
Yeah, the way it works today is we've got people who need to be back on planes and need to be back into Colac for dinner. And we therefore are only doing questions at the... we were talking
yes.
for questions. So if you've got a question, write it down and put it on a piece of paper or just keep it in your head, and we'll be calling for those questions later.
Just before lunch and then also after the afternoon session. So we're not doing Q&A after each session. It's a collective question.
And just in your mind, just to get you ready, in previous years we have had lunch as part of the ticket price. Today lunch is will be provided by the good traders along the foreshore here, or your own packed lunch if you bought one of those as well.
And sticks and bones.
Sticks and bones. I forgot about sticks and bones.
They're
up
there.
Thank you, Liz.
They're just outside.
So now we've got Liz there. We'll just have a look at that lady there in the red.
Thanks, Liz.
Liz, can we just point out that this lady has worked tirelessly to bring people, you in this room and the speakers together. She's worked really hard. And Liz, can I just say that at the same time you've done that on the background, and I hope I'm not speaking out of terms here, but she did this whilst selling her beautiful property on the edge of town, surrounded, you know, she's going to have to say goodbye to the galahs and to the little superb wrens that kept her busy every morning, and the wattle birds and the New Holland honey eaters. So that she had to say goodbye to that place, and she settled at just before the dinner on Friday night. She's had all that going and then pulled off this amazing event, Liz. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And congratulations on the sale. I'm going to turn around this way. Because we have... Time is short. But before we go any further, I'd really like to acknowledge the Gadabunud land that we are meeting on today and also acknowledge elders past, present and emerging. Now, first talk. We've got about 20 minutes. And I know you three well enough to know that we could talk all day.
Almost unheard.
Now, anyone who has been here in the last 2 years will know this is, again, the third year that we've had. This is the first talk. I am honoured to introduce three of the directors of the Apollo Bay Seafood... Apollo Bay Fisheries Co-op.
Fisherman's Co-op. Yeah.
Fisherman's Co-op. Three of the directors, we've got Nick Polgeist, Russell Frost, a.k.a. Frosty, and Marcus Nolly. Please welcome my mates.
Thank you.
The talk we have, we did this as I said, 2018, then 2019, and it's a great update. It's a chance to know what's been going on in this community for the last 12 months. I'm going to start with you, Frosty, because we're going to sort of go local first. You are on the coalface. You are out in the water a lot. Yeah, pretty much every day, yeah?
Well, if the weather's fine, I am. Yeah.
So tell us what's going on out there.
What's going on out there?
For the last year, how's it been?
How would you describe it? Last year, I think because we work under a quota-managed system, the quota was caught quite easily. This year, we started off I don't know if a lot of people work on the land noticed how late everything is this year. The same thing happened on the sea. And when we went to work in August and September, the things that you were expecting to see didn't happen.
Okay. What were you expecting?
Well, you often see the crayfish grow by a molt. They lose their shell and that's how they grow. Well, in August, September, you always see a molt of the little males. Right. This year, that didn't happen. Okay. So they weren't in the catch. So what we caught were big fish, which was quite unusual to get such a percentage of the big fish. Mm-hmm. And when we had the 10 weeks off, and then we went back in November, and it was a really strange start because we were catching fish, but they're all really little. We couldn't keep them.
Okay. Well, and what do you... Is this about the waters warming?
I think this has got to do with the season being late.
Yes.
You know, and then I thought, oh, yeah, this is going to be a really poor year. So we worked hard. I had a bit of an accident in mid-December and put us out of action for a while.
You okay?
Oh, we're all right.
Good on you. Okay.
We're still here.
I know, thank goodness.
I better take his pulse.
Okay, could you make sure he's there?
And most people that have been here the last few years, my history is that I've done population dynamics works for the fisheries for the last 25 years. I think in that time I've tagged and measured over 30,000 fish, which a lot of that is used on the basis of our stock assessment and our TAC setting. And we do that in February every year. So the way the fish had been through sort of December and January, thought, oh, yeah, we're not going to catch any. So we started it early in February. Mm-hmm. I think the first day we tagged 150, which is quite phenomenal. The next day we tagged 175. And the last day we tagged nearly 300.
Wow.
And I haven't finished yet. And besides that, there was all the whole cohort of fish were there. It wasn't just the little ones.
Yep.
So the fish are driven by environmental inputs that we don't really know anything about.
Okay.
And so you know, somehow we've got to be able to factor in the input that climate has on everything we do, fishing, farming, living.
Yes.
So, I'm pleasantly surprised that there is a good future in the ocean.
That's wonderful. That's great news. Can we move, because we only have a short time. We'll move to you next, Nick. We're bringing it all together. Tell us about market then. If we're pleasantly surprised and there's a nice little positive vibe around it. What's going on in the marketplace and at the co-op?
The marketplace was going really well until the December the 26th. The coronavirus hit us and hit us like a ton of bricks. It was almost like a financial tsunami. Didn't see it coming. Here it was. No export at all. You've got to realise that 95% of all lobsters in Australia, northern lobsters from the tropical part of Australia, Western Australia, South Australia, Tassie and Victoria, all go to China. It's a mono market. So once that happens, everything stopped. And unfortunately, there's processors in Australia right now sitting on 20 tonne of lobsters they can't sell. And what I say they can't sell, they can sell it on the local market. However, having said that, they've paid very large prices for it because every year when Chinese New Year comes up, and this year, the year of the rat, of course, ratusfincus, mongrel thing. but it's sort of all of a sudden, it's here. And before it arrives, we all stock up heavily in our tanks. We stock up around about 4 to 5 tonne if we can. So, and some of these big processors, they're far bigger. They handle 400 tonne. We do a fraction of that. And to get the rug pulled from under them, and they've paid top dollar to fishermen. They've paid a lot of money for it, hoping for the price to rise, which it does every year. And it didn't happen this year, and they lost something like $40 to $50 a kilo on this product. It's massive. Some of these processors have been in the business a long time, will go broke. There's no question about it.
And they just can't go out there at the moment, you were saying, is that right?
How do you mean?
Well, as in fishing, they can't go out. You said it's just stopped completely.
Well, the fishermen have been dealt a lifesaver, basically. They're allowed to now carry over their quota into next year. So they can make the decision to keep on fishing and take less for their product and sell it, and we sell it through the co-op on the local market, or they can actually roll that over into next year's quota year, which starts on the 1st of July. And that's great, you know, but is this coronavirus going to stop? I mean, it's arrived and it's antidote and medicine will probably take at least 18 months.
They're saying at least a year. So they're
telling us. So that means China will open up slowly and in a very small way. Certain sections of China will probably open up. We're hoping that.
Yes.
And that'll give us a bit of sort of clear air.
Great. And in the meantime, how do we help as consumers?
Just keep buying those crayfish, lobsters. We got stacks of them.
Everyone, okay, crayfish sandwiches in school lunch boxes. Thanks very much. That's what I'm thinking. Educate the children.
Well, you can buy lobsters at the moment at a really good price at the co-op, $85 cooked. And before that, it was $125, and in Melbourne, $150 to $160. So, there's an example of, something goes haywire and there's opportunities for other people, and that's business.
Great. Thank you. And Marcus, I'd love a wrap-up. And, well, your year, you have had one hell of a year. You look after, you're about government policy.
Yeah, so...
And I just, if I may ask just very quickly, going on what you were saying, Nick, if, in terms of licences and what you're allowed to catch, they can only catch crayfish, if there was an opportunity to actually go out and catch other fish, would that be helpful to this community?
Well, absolutely. We've seen, the history of fishing really goes... It started at a time when if you wanted to be a fisherman, you would get a master fisherman's licence. What do they cost, Nick? A couple of pounds, perhaps?
£2.
£2. And what that meant was you could go fishing. You got a boat, you just needed something to keep you above the water, and you went fishing. And if there was good lobster fishing, you'd go and catch lobsters. If that wasn't good, you'd go and catch something else. Well, these days it's all changed, you know, which is a good thing. So all of the major sort of species that we catch are all under quota, as Nick mentioned. So we have annual quotas that are set. But because we do it like that, everything's become very specific. So, for example, I've got a rock lobster licence, but that just lets me catch rock lobster, nothing else. So I can't go and catch shark or other fish. So the trouble is that because it's got so specific, and exactly because, you know, now we've got this coronavirus, we've got particularly a lot of the younger guys now who have invested a lot in their assets, in their boats and their equipment, and they're tied up in the harbour now doing nothing because all they're allowed to catch is rock lobster, and if the bottom's fallen out of the rock lobster market, they can't go and catch anything else. They're not allowed to. Now, we've had the government... Oh, actually, first of all, if the Minister for Fisheries, the Honourable Jala Pulver, could just stand up. Oh, OK. Any senior executives from the Victorian Fisheries Authority, could you please stand up? Oh, any members of the Victorian Fisheries Authority Board, could you please stand up? Oh, that's strange. Therein lies the problem. Yes. They're not in the room. You know,
no, they're not in the room. Conversation.
So we're not having the conversations we need to have to actually support this industry.
How hard would it be to get those licences changed, extended, expanded? Why won't they do it?
It's a no-brainer. The trouble is at the moment we've got the state government is just ideologically obsessed with recreational fishers. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, I was a recreational fisher before I became a commercial fisher. Yes. And recreational fishers have lived side by side with commercial fishers forever, and there's no reason why we can't into the future. But this government is basically taking away your resource, your fish that commercial fishers bring home for you. Yes. They are exclusively allocating that to recreational fishers because they think it'll buy votes. So we've seen over, you know, 600 tonnes per annum of fresh, sustainable fish that otherwise would be brought to market for the benefit of Victorians given exclusively to recreational fishers in Port Phillip Bay, down at Gippsland Lakes now. The commercial fishers are being told to pack up their nets and go home. So you are losing access to your sustainable fresh fish because of this ideology of the current government.
There was recently in the paper, and we touched on this the other day, that you said it was tokenistic. You can have 2 tonnes here and we can buy fish from fishing boats.
Yeah, look,
is it a sort of romantic idea?
It's an embarrassment. The government has this sort of Disneyfied sort of Disneyland version of what our niche fishery should look like with, you know, salty old men coming in on their boats.
Singing songs.
Yeah,
you know. And chewing tobacco.
Singing sea shanties.
Yeah. With big steins of beer.
That bit's true, actually. So they've handed out a couple of these permits to say, oh, okay, you know, it's like breadcrumbs. Oh, you can go and catch this fish or that fish on a special little permit, not a license, just a permit. But you can only catch this much, and you're not allowed to touch the fish that the recreational fishers like. I had a text from one of our fishers out there who was trying to use this pathetic, what he called a toy permit, to try and catch a few fish to come in and sell at the market yesterday. And I got a text from him. He said, I've just caught this beautiful kingfish, but I've got to put it back because it's not on my toy permit because the fisheries, Victorian Fisheries Authority, won't let him bring the kingfish home because that's something that the recreational fishers like to catch. So sorry, you can't have it.
We need to wrap up.
And also, you as the public actually miss out. You're being dudded.
Frosty, we've got to wrap up. So no, not as in great.
Just one thing. There is a mechanism that we can access the fish. It's called an ocean access licence. I've got one. Nick's got one. Any of the old fishermen have got them. They're non-transferable. The government wants them to disappear, to open up the ocean to the recreationals, as well as the bays and inlets.
That's right.
If they would allow these licences to be made transferable, they have the full gamut of access to any type of fishing equipment you want to use. But they will not ideologically allow these licences to be transferred, and they have not for the last 25 years.
Why? And it's gone. What's from the reason?
They're becoming anti-commercial.
That's gone from 800 of these licences to, I think, there's 150 left because us stubborn old buggers have hung on to them.
Yay.
Now, it is something that should be agitated by all of you people if you want access to good local fish for these licences to be made available to be transferred to these younger blokes so they've got a future.
How do we do that? How do we do that?
We go to our local members and we agitate.
Okay.
We say, we want local fish. What you are doing is a farce. You're just trying to, you know, big note yourself in the paper. You've got people talking on the radio about this beautiful thing. There is a way to get the fish. They've just got to be allowed to do it.
And the ministers are just after a few lousy votes.
Yeah.
So
that's what it's about.
Let's start agitating. See, we could keep talking for hours, but you please thank Nick Polgeist, Russell Frost and Marcus Nolley. Thank you. And are you guys around today? If anyone has any questions for you,
absolutely,
can people come and just chat to you one-on-one today? Please, they love a chat. We all love a chat. It's good.
I think so.
I think we do. Well, I think I'm up. So do you.
Yes, we're going to do a changeover now. Do you want to finish up there and we'll do the changeover?
Done.
All right, good.
Okay.
You done?
I am done. We're finished.
Done.
Full stop.
We're sharing a cabin and she didn't leave. She left the shower mat down. We're still trying to get over that.
We are not. We've been great flatmates for a couple of years, but this, I don't know, me leaving the bath mat on the floor, it's triggered all sorts of things in you, darling.
Okay. We need a couple of people up here now, don't we? We need I think we might get someone. We might get Matt up. Matt. We need these gentlemen down.
Thank you.
Okay, we're just while we're resetting, I just want to point out that the good people at Galapagos Bookstore are here. That's Caroline over there. Hello, wave. She's got a few books out here. One of them's from a chap you might have seen on television. I don't know. His name's Matthew Evans. He sort of pops up in front of Cavern every now and then. So his books are on sale there. Bruce Pascoe's works are there. But also, more importantly, is my book, Brain Food. I think it's a very reasonable price, $19.99 today. And every question you've ever wanted to know about food has been asked in this. It's actually a very good book, as is Matthew's. Okay. Hillary. Oh, we're ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, excellent.
Having a sip of water?
Okay. Okay, Hillary.
Good morning. Again. Over this side now. Are you all right?
Yeah,
good?
Yeah, good.
Comfy? Good. Water?
Can I grab your water bottle? Ours is a bit...
Manky.
Coming out slow. Yeah. Oh, you managed to get it off.
Oh, okay. It is now my pleasure. You need no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. Please welcome Matthew Evans, farmer, chef, author, writer, and also Jonathan Davey, director of Seafood Industry Victoria. We are on a board together. I should just, a quick disclaimer, I am on the board of Seafood Industry Victoria with Jonathan, just putting it out there. Sorry, I don't mean to have my back to you, but I need to talk to these guys. We are talking about labelling.
Oh, I thought we were talking about bath mats.
Oh. If you've got any etiquette tips for me, how to share a house with someone...
You don't leave it on the floor.
Oh, I usually don't. I just had a mascara trauma. There was things going on. I had to run out the door. Okay, no, everyone's going to know. I think I'm messy now. Anyway, we're back to labelling and bath mats. It's a pleasure to have you both here because I'm a bit confused about quite a few things now. And particularly seafood labelling, when I go to the Queen Vic Market and I go to the fishmonger that I like to visit, everything that's out there tells me where it's from, product of Australia or where it's from, and I can ask them and they know, they have to know and they have to tell me. If I go to a restaurant and I say to the waiter, where's the fish from or what kind of fish is that, they don't have to tell me. And I, as someone who loves to eat out and loves seafood and loves the local industry and loves Australian seafood, I want to know, and I want to actually also enjoy the seafood culture that we're trying to grow and trying to nurture. Why can we not know in a restaurant? Matthew, could you go first?
Yeah, why don't you know? Because there's a handful of people in Australia who don't want you to know. So mostly, so just to put it in context, every box of seafood that's brought into Australia has the species on it and where it's come from. Well, the last port of call maybe, but you know, the origin of where how it came into Australia. And every tub of seafood that comes off a fishing boat has you know, the species and the, you know, the name of the fishing boat usually, and the date it was caught and all that kind of stuff. And all this is recorded, so all this information exists. But what's happened is 75% of the seafood we eat in Australia isn't Australian. And there's a handful of people, generally seafood importers, and then people organisations that run some of the biggest catering operations lobbying groups for them. So the Restaurant and Catering Association of Australia, Australian Hotels Association, who don't want you to know what you're eating. And the reason they don't want you to know what you're eating is because they want you to think that you're supporting your local fishermen, like the three guys we just saw sitting up here before. They want you to think that every time you go to buy flathead, it's come from a salty sea dog, with his shanty songs. They don't want you to know that it's come from somewhere else, from possibly an unsustainable fishery. They want you to live the dream, and by keeping you in the dark, that is their way of piggybacking on the good reputation and the good management of Australian fisheries, but substitute lesser quality fish that may have come from poorer systems overseas.
Okay, and Jonathan, do you want to add to that? Why do you think it's happening? Why does it happen?
So what we're hearing, as obviously the advocate for industry and working alongside Matt and others in terms of pushing for country of origin labelling in the food service sector,
yes.
The claim we always hear from the people who are against labelling is it's too expensive. Our people won't afford it. And I know from going to some of the better restaurants in Melbourne where they actually thrive on identifying and labelling seafood properly.
And training their staff.
People aren't against imported seafood. Frozen seafood can be just as good as fresh seafood.
Absolutely.
If it's handled properly.
Yes.
So there's this phobia that it's going to drive seafood sales down if we start labelling it properly. Having to reprint menus based on what's available on the day is going to cost money. Most restaurants do that anyway.
That's just excuses, isn't it? It's a business cost. Yeah.
That's the argument that's been thrown up, that politicians are sitting there going, well, it might cost a bit too much, so we won't do it.
So as in, but it cost a bit too much also in terms of actually just creating this policy as well. What do you think?
Yeah, the stat, well, it's a few years since I've looked at what they were talking about. They were saying that it was going to cost each restaurant, cafe, bistro, sushi shop, whatever, $7,500 to comply with country of origin labelling. So to be able to tell you whether your prawns came from Thailand or from Australia, or whether your sardines were from, Port Phillip Bay or from Spain, was going to cost $7,500 per restaurant per year, right? Now, I went out and bought a box of chalk. It cost me...
7 cents.
Yeah, I think it was $4, and I got 50 pieces of chalk.
Yep.
And I swear, years later, I haven't run out of a single piece of chalk, and I've written a lot of lists with that. Like, it's not that hard. And then I think what really frustrates me about this is because it's not like they're going, oh, this compliance, right? Oh, I've got to do all this compliance. Mm. It's going to cost the restaurants, right? Man, the fishermen already comply. The fishermen already put the work in. We've already got all the information. It already exists. It exists at the importer. It exists at the fishing boat. It exists at the wholesalers. Mm. It exists everywhere if you buy it retail, but it doesn't exist for some reason between the back door of the restaurant and the dining table. That information is lost.
Mm.
Because it's very easy for a wholesaler to put that information onto their invoice, and it is no great burden for a restaurant to be able to tell you where their seafood has come from, by either using a piece of chalk, verbally, a whiteboard, or some other some other method. It doesn't cost seven. It doesn't. It's not. It's really not hard. They can do it with everything else. They just choose not to, and they choose not to because they're trying to hide something.
And they're trying to, as you say, help us live a false dream. It's, lull us into a false sense of security.
And I don't know, I'll just give you an example from where I live, because I know that sort of around the southeast trawl fishery, it's the same sort of thing. Where I live near a river, but the river is brackish. So at the bottom of my road, 800 metres from my farm, there's an old apple shed. You can sit on the couch, because it's now converted into a home, you can sit on the couch and catch a flathead right off there. The nearest fish and chip shop to me sells flathead. That flathead that the fish and chip shop sells near me is not flathead at all. It's a thing called Argentinian stickfish. It's a bottom trawled fish from the south South America, from what all my understanding is a quite unsustainable fishery. But it comes in really cheap. The fillets look very similar to flathead, and it's sold as flathead because legally they can pretend that it is, and they don't have to tell you it's from Argentina. So when people go and buy fish, they think they're buying the fish that you can catch within 200 metres of that fish and chip shop.
Yep.
And so they're trading. It's just a way of scamming the public when the public deserve better.
We do. And I just went laughing, legally pretending. I didn't know pretending was ever legal. You know, but it's actually a point, because people are just taking the piss, if you
will. Yeah, they are. I mean, right. you're not allowed to sell lamb as beef, right? You're just not. But I can sell Argentinian stickfish as flathead. Like, they're two completely different species. Just because they live in the ocean doesn't mean they're less of a species, you know, the difference in species. So why the difference? I don't understand the difference, but I understand there are vested interests who don't want us to know where things are coming from, because they can sell very cheap a very cheap product that has questionable origins, and pretend it is comes from the salty sea dog down the road with the little fishing boat.
Have you talked to the fish shop about the stickfish?
Yeah, I didn't talk to them. I've talked to another one nearby. And what's really interesting is that shop, they said, "Oh Christ, that's really interesting." And they put up $7,500 whiteboard, and they had their
whiteboard.
And they had their imported Argentinian stickfish on their permanent board above the takeaway. It's a takeaway, fish and chip shop, you know, battered fish, you know. And then they had this little Tasmanian fish board. And, you know, you went, oh, it's $8.50 for a piece of the Argentinian stuff. It's like 15 or 14 for the Tasmanian stuff. And they said 90% of people, and this is an impoverished corner of southern Tasmania, they've all got holes in their jumpers. These people don't have a lot of money. 90% of people chose the Australian stuff. And they chose it because they wanted to support their local community. They wanted some, and then when they bought it, they realised it tasted better. Mm. And they made a choice with their wallets every time. So it didn't mean that the imported stuff wasn't there. And I met the guy who said, I'm going to eat the most endangered shark, the last shark on Earth. You know, they're not doing it necessarily for environmental reasons, but he might have wanted to eat the last Australian shark on Earth. Yeah. But it gives him the chance to make an informed decision. Mm. And knowing and trusting what you eat is not, I think it's really not a bad concept, and why we can't know and trust what we eat in terms of seafood when we go out to eat is a mystery.
It's trust, isn't it? And Jonathan, just on that, with the industry, I love that people do choose Australian. Do you have a lot of support within the industry, not only fishermen, but people, chefs, people you talk to? I think a lot of us just want to buy Australian, want to know what we're eating. Encourage a seafood culture. What do you find?
So we're seeing at the moment consumer trends are changing, where everyone you want to know what you're putting in your mouth, what you're exposing your body to.
And I want to know that I'm supporting a community
exactly
that's local
right.
to me.
So we look at the moment, the Northern Territory is the only state in Australia where food service sector have to have country of origin labelling. They don't have any issues with it. They got on and did it.
Wow.
Mind
okay,
you,
I
when you look
that.
At when you look at the Northern Territory, there's 34 pubs and clubs. There's 1,500 plus pubs across Victoria. So those numbers, you know, make it a little bit harder here.
A bit longer. Surely it's just time.
So we've got politicians who support country of origin labelling and support rolling it out in Victoria, except it's not sexy. It's not a vote grab. So it just gets left off.
So is it about changing the angle? Like Richard and I were talking this morning about commercialism versus culture. This is all about creating a beautiful culture of knowing and celebrating our local produce. So how do we work on culture?
I think what it is, and Marcus and the guys talked about it before, it's about us as the community realising there's an opportunity for change and what we have to do to make change.
Yes.
It's not about me or Matt or single advocates going out there and trying to champion for something. We need a groundswell movement. We need people saying, I want to know where that's coming from, and going and having a chat with your local politician, putting it in their head as to something that's really easy to do, straightforward, and delivers some benefit for the community
in
general.
This. I'm actually smiling because I'm thinking all our members are going to get all these emails from tomorrow. I was at the Apollo Bay Seafood Festival. I would love that. I'm going to do some agitating tomorrow.
Definitely.
For sure. But also, well, let's bring in just even the naming of fish, because I think that also makes life a bit confusing. Just as in, yes, there's a standardised fish name, but what's a crayfish at a southern rock lobster? What's a perch? What's an ocean cod? You know, these generic names. Do you want to touch on that, Matt? Sorry, you go first, Jonathan.
We do have in Australia an Australian fish name standard.
Yes, we do.
But it's a voluntary measure. So.
And have you gone on fishnames.com.au? They don't have the obsolete names anymore. We were looking at it this
correct.
Morning. They don't. We couldn't find them. They used to. I remember because I've looked at it a lot in my life. And the obsolete names are gone.
So again, there is a voluntary standard. It's something that would actually, Matt talked about compliance in terms of country of origin labelling.
Yes.
Compliance of fish name standards, again, is who does it? How do they do it? How do they fund it? What does it look like?
Do you know the answers to that?
No.
No, this is... And you're no. on, you know, you're yeah. in the fire. You're there and we're all trying to do this and none of us know where... The funding. Do you know much about it?
Yeah, I know a little bit. Yeah. So just to put it in context, it's probably, and I'll probably get the numbers wrong, sorry for the professionals in this industry, but there's probably about 600 species of fish that we catch in Australia that are commercially viable, right, about over the years from all Australian waters. And they all have names. They all have Latin names, but they've been working for over 20 years, people from the industry, from the fishing industry, from the wholesale industry and from government to come up with, and scientists, to come up with standardised names. So not giving them the Latin name, a normal name that you and I can understand and pronounce, and say, well, that fish is, you know, gold band snapper, or that fish is... blue eye traveller, and that's the name it's supposed to use. And for all of that time, it's been voluntary whether you use those names or not. So lots of people who want to pretend they've got something they don't either make up a name or misuse a name. And the great example is Pacific Dory. Pacific Dory is a nice marketing term. The Pacific, it sounds nice and blue. Dory, we all, you know, love a silver Dory or a John Dory. Mm. You know, with you know, the St. John's thumbprint on the side, isn't it? But that you and I would actually recognise better if it was called Mekong Delta catfish, because it's a catfish. Some people are allergic to catfish.
Seriously?
And it comes from the Mekong Delta. Its mother marketing name is Bassa. Okay, so
yes,
that you might have heard
everywhere.
Of Bassa, right? But so if you have a standardised name, then people can't just go, oh, I've got Pacific Dory on the menu or whatever and make up some name. I went to a place called Snappers in... I probably can't mention it, but you cut this out of the podcast. Anyway, I went to a place called Snappers in Canberra. It's called Snappers. It's a fish and chip shop, right?
Okay. So, everyone, Instagram, Snappers,
and,
Canberra.
And guess
here
what,
we go.
Guess what they don't have on the menu?
Snapper.
They have it called Snapper. When you ask, actually, is it Snapper? No, it's not. It was hake from South Africa. Well, that's fine, but we'll just call it hake. You know, like
from South Africa.
Yeah. So what we've had is 20 years of voluntary labelling of, you know, using these names, actual names, normal names that you would define these fish as individual species, and that has failed because places have decided that they couldn't be bothered, don't want to, couldn't care less, or want to, or more importantly, generally want to hide what they're selling, and it breaks my heart because, and you meet the people who worked on this for you know, two decades of their life and put so much effort in, and it's a big two fingers up from the people who want to not have you know what you're eating.
As someone who worked in hospitality front of house for a long time and enjoyed it, but cared about the customer, the fact that you're actually lying to someone, and it breaks my heart, it really does. Jonathan, how can we fix this?
It's a really good question.
Here. Hi, Jonathan.
No.
Can you solve the world's problems?
Yeah.
So what we're trying to do as industry now is work forward on a solution on our own. So we've created a Victorian seafood logo. Obviously, getting a logo out there, making sure it's traceability and something you can put your hand on your heart and say, this is Victorian seafood, costs a bit of money and we don't have that at the moment, but we're voluntary trying to roll it out, working through some of the fishers, getting it out there in terms of coming to the festivals, teaching people about what is Victorian seafood. Try something different and love it. Ask for it. As soon as we start to get people recognising, again, what are the common fish names for Victoria,
yes.
Start asking for it. Demand it through your local fish shop. When you go to a restaurant, ask them if they cook with it. Yes. And just starting that conversation and building a movement in terms of people wanting to know where their product comes from. And that's really all we can do at the moment. And until there is some higher level government support, of which from a Commonwealth perspective, there isn't. And realistically, the legislation needs to be driven through the Commonwealth so that it's a national standard applied across the country, as opposed to each state adopting something different. But at the moment, the will to do it isn't there. So we've got to push on and do it ourselves.
I guess, and we have people, writers and chefs. We've got some chefs who are coming up next to chat. But and I think, can I throw a question to you, Dave Moyle?
Yeah.
Do you have, you talk about, you and Local Seafood and Long Song, Manny, do you put where your fish is from?
Yeah, I was just saying how low the baseline is as far as it should be. You know, it should almost be like an accepted piece of information that it is Victorian unless otherwise classified, you know? Like, it's sort of... So, I don't know. Like, I communicate it a lot.
Yeah. We the staff, use... the front of house staff communicate it?
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, it does sound a little bit... It can sound a little bit patronising when you start talking about what the species is, where it's fished from, so on and so forth. It's obviously important. But do I always do it? No. I champion and support it, but it does become a difficult
thing. Yeah, I think in the Northern Territory, they just have to say whether it's imported or not. I don't think it's actually necessarily full country of origin, but you don't have to say if it's Northern Territory.
Yeah.
So the default position is it's local.
Yep.
And that switches the narrative because at the moment, 75%, probably more in food service when you go out to eat, of seafood is imported, but we presume it's local. You know, 90% of the time people think it's local when 90% of the time it's not.
It's scary to see how many people operate like that, I guess, is the main point. Yeah.
But you use Australian seafood and New Zealand?
100%. So, yeah, purely. And New Zealand. We do touch on New Zealand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the start. I often see chefs and restaurants as the drivers of change and the agents of change in terms of getting a conversation
But never, ever underestimate. And, you know... When we talk about, you know, contacting your member or whatever, but don't underestimate your actions every time you make a purchase. Okay. Like if anyone's worked in restaurants, if you get 5 customers in a week, it only takes 5 customers in a week to say, oh, what sort of snapper? Where did it come from? You know, then suddenly the waiter's onto the chefs. The chefs are going, oh, fuck, I better ring the wholesaler and find out actually what is going on.
Yeah.
And very quickly, and I've had this, we did a documentary on seafood a few years ago, and I've had wholesalers come up to me and say, oh, you know, I'm getting so many questions from chefs about the origins of my seafood now. So you don't underestimate your power every time you go out to eat to just say, oh, where's it from? Oh, do you know exactly, you know, which variety of, you know, flathead it is or snapper it is? And if they don't know, it's not a big deal, you know. Like, it doesn't mean they're necessarily trying to hide something, but you're triggering, every time you're triggering the idea that provenance matters.
It certainly does. And I think this is it, the agency and the power we have as consumers to drive demand, because that's what we do, really, as consumers.
Yeah,
and
right.
We have to wrap up in only a few minutes. That's any other tips you can give us on how to help and support our industry, agitate, contact parliament, members of parliament on state?
As Matt just said, every time you go out, just ask, where is it? Where's it from?
Yeah,
what is it?
Yeah,
as
where are you
as
catching
this? As
soon
as we start this? To get that question out there, ask, is it local? Ask where it's from. Most places will actually, a lot of the chefs now want to have a close relationship with the fisher.
Yes.
So they'll actually be able to say who caught it and where.
That's exciting.
And that sort of narrative is starting to grow, and I think it's only going to continue to grow to the point where it'll become more of a personal dining experience.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I think it's multi-tiered, so it's really important every time you buy something, every time you go out to it, that you feel free to ask those questions and expect an answer. And then people, you know, if you want to write to your local member or you have some group that you're affiliated with that can make, maybe make some change higher up. But for us, I think one of the big things that we would like to see is the voluntary labelling has failed. And all this, you know, talking to David Moyle and all these great chefs and you know, the places you might visit where you can ask these questions and they'll give you an honest answer, the law doesn't protect you from them. The law only protects you from the shonks and charlatans. And what we've had is 25, 30 years of voluntary labelling that has failed. And what we really need to protect you, the customer, and give you the information you need to make choices about your what you put in your mouth and consume is that we do actually need another layer, which is a little some regulations around this to say, look, just tell us what it is. It's not a big deal, and ideally also tell us where it's from. And that information, as I say, already exists. It's not a big drama to get it from the back of the restaurant to the consumer.
Please thank Matthew Evans and Jonathan Davies.
Thank you.